Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of the Personal Wealth Coach Second Hour on this February 18th, 2017. And if you'd like to join us in here, actually, you won't be joining us, but only your voice would. You can give us a call at 254-773-1400.
All right.
Let me do a market update.
Yeah, we usually start first hour with that, and we didn't do it, so go ahead.
So the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which we don't pay that much attention to, was up 1.75%. The S&P 500, which we do pay attention to, was up 1.5% for the week. Now, there's some better news. I mean, there's some really, I like that term. Don't you think?
President should use really?
All those reallys?
You just say tremendous or
tremendously
fantastic.
Really good news there, too. The 52-week return, in other words, if you look at the value of the Dow Jones Industrial Average exactly 1 year ago, 52 weeks ago, it's up 25.82%. The S&P 500 is up 22.6. If you measured from February 11th of last year, it's up. The S&P 500 is up 28%. Now, why? Because last year at this time, the deflation was a big threat. The world was coming to an end. The bottom was dropping out of the oil market, and I know it was ancient history, but in the fall before that, the Chinese economy was going to collapse. But fundamentally, there was a great deal of irrational pessimism in the market a year ago. And had a person decided to invest in some broad spectrum product that represented most of the market, the returns they would have seen in the last 12 months would remind them of actually be better than what they saw in the late 1990s. Now, last year, and as usual, we have been accused of being unreasonably optimistic. We're always optimistic. Well, I'm going to be a little pessimistic here for just a moment.
Optimistic about certain areas. I have to throw that in there because we've talked about bubbles and where they exist. But
we have been accused of being excessively optimistic, and we really are optimistic. I mean, when we started, let's put it like this. I can easily remember when the Dow Jones Industrial Average crossed 1,000. I can remember when it crossed 2,000. And the fact that it is at 20,624 right now would indicate that my optimism back then was correct. But I'm going to throw a little bit of a pessimistic note in here. As we mentioned last hour, a lot of the up in the market right now that is so delightful is based on the promise of things happening that may not happen. As a result, it's possible. I would go so far as to say probable that we're going to get a correction. We're going to get a dip in the market. Now, does that mean there's something fundamentally wrong with the economy? No, we're going to talk about that this hour. Industrial production, despite the fact that it's the headline number was down, was in fact up. Retail sales are up. Inflation is muted. It's not excessive. It's there, but it's about where it's supposed to be. Everything really looks good in the underlying economy. However, it looked good before the market ran up too. It's just that psychologically the market has run up, and because of the fact that it's run up on psychology, I wouldn't be terribly surprised to see if there's any disappointment.
Same reason. It could run down
because I'll just be very frank. The tax breaks that we're looking for are stalled in Congress with different people competing on how to pay for it or not pay for it. And big chunks of the Republicans are saying that we're going to borrow the money to do a tax cut in the hope that somewhere down the road we'll have more revenue, which is one of the ideas that's being put forward. As the news said, those of you who are online won't have heard that, but as the news said a few moments ago, there is no consensus on how to replace Obamacare. In fact, there are lots of ideas on how to replace Obamacare, none of which seem like they have any great hope of passing. So until there's a breakout in leadership somewhere, the probabilities of all the optimism coming to pass are pretty slim. So now, what does that mean? Does that mean you should short the market or bail out of the market or something?
No.
Absolutely not. Because, again, the underlying economy is sufficient, at least in our opinion, to support the market where it is right now. But that doesn't mean that people might not get disappointed and become pessimistic and suddenly bolt in the other direction temporarily. So just be aware that we've gone a long time without a true correction in the market. That's 20% drop. We've now gone a year without even a 13% drop in the market, which we had last year about this time. And since they occur on average about once every 18 months, and that's just the average, I think it is very reasonable to expect at some point this year to get a sudden market pullback. And when it happens, you'll say, oh, yeah, they told us this was going to happen. Don't worry about it. And that's what we're saying to you. The economy is in great shape.
Yeah, we're talking about
– right.
We're talking about the stock market and whether or not the big run-up we've had could lead to a drop. We don't think that the market is overpriced. But when you have a run-up associated with psychology and you don't see the results of the expectation, if people are making their decisions based on their expectations and they think Mr. Smith is in Washington, so things are going to get changed – unfortunately, this happens. It's not Mr. Smith.
His name is Mr. Trump.
Right, Mr. Trump.
Yes.
Jimmy Stewart played a good role there with the senator and, you know, going and changing Washington immediately. Uh-huh. And that's kind of the fairy tale. Fairy tale that both Obama and Trump have believed, that when they get there, that they can make an immediate and fundamental shift in the way that the country is being operated. And both of them will have a big shift in the way the country's operated, but it's not immediate. It takes a lot of time. And if you believe the rhetoric, you know, on day one, we'll have Obamacare repealed. Well, the president can't repeal Obamacare. The Congress has to, and Congress doesn't follow. I mean, it's like taking a kindergarten class on a field trip when you're the only teacher. If there's 500 some odd kids in that kindergarten class and you say, we're going to go this way, and about half of them, little under half of them, don't like you. And the larger majority of them are still kindergarten kids, even if they like you. They have their own interests. They'll see a bug. They're going to wander off. This is a really big kindergarten class, yeah. And that's Congress.
Are you saying that? Yeah, you're comparing Congress to a kindergarten class.
Yeah, and the government is the only other institution besides a bunch of five-year-olds that measure ages in half years. So are you 59 and a half? Well, Congress has said that that's important. So did the five-and-a-half-year-old down the street. So just know that Obama ran into the same brick wall that Trump is running into. He had a Democrat majority in the House and the Senate when he took office. And he got one major thing passed in that two-year period. There's a lot of things he could have gotten passed, but he got one, and that was Obamacare. That was the Affordable Care Act. And it happened in a way that caused the Republicans to hate him and it. And that's, you know, we're talking about many years later, and we're having the same conversation about repeal and replace that started at that point. Now, you know, I've talked about this in the past. If the Republicans make the same mistake that the Democrats did, which is do not make this at all bipartisan, cram it down the other party's throat.
Which they're doing,
and they're not showing any sign of slowing down in doing that, then we're going to have this conversation again at some point in the not-too-distant future. Because unless we can work together on this as Americans – you know, even Medicare, which was definitely a Democrat incentivized program, had Republicans vote for it. And even the Reagan tax cuts had Democrats vote for it. That's the way you keep permanency in law, is that you get both teams to agree on the details. Now, that's not fun because you got to negotiate, and you got to give people what they want and what you don't want to give away. But without it, you don't have permanency, and you get the repeal motto going for Obamacare. And whatever replaces Obamacare, if they ever repeal it, that's a big if, it needs to have bipartisan support or it's going to get repealed and replaced next time around, next time there's a shift in power. And the thing that you should recognize is that no matter how many times people say the revolution has occurred, we are now going to get what we want. Well, they said that about Obama. They're saying that about Trump. It's different people saying it.
There's a couple of numbers came out this week that we pay a lot of attention to, but look positive, even though on the surface they look negative. And that's one of the it's not fake news. It's a matter of digging down. The headline doesn't tell the underlying story. For example, the headline on industrial production in the United States was that it fell. Well, industrial production includes, as one of its largest components, the manufacture of electricity and the use of fuel in our society. And you might think, manufacturing? Why has it got that? Well, because the power plant manufactures electricity. I don't know what else you'd call it. The end result is because we had the warmest January, whether or not you believe in global warming, we did in fact have the warmest January in the United States on record since we've been measuring such things, and there's no indication we've ever had one this warm since people have been here and keeping records.
Right. There are lots of indication that the planet has had warmer summers, just not since people have been running around.
Yes, it's been a long time ago, right. So the point is that people didn't use as much electricity in January as they normally use to heat their homes and so on. They didn't use as much fuel oil. They didn't use as much a lot of things. The end result of that is that industrial production appears to have dropped. In fact, if you pull those numbers out and you look at the real industrial production, where things are actually being made that we would typically think of as industrial.
Number of units being produced.
Yeah, we're up.
Number.
We're up.
We're up. We're producing more with less electricity.
Then there was the inflation number of 2.5% year over year. But the inflation number, it's going to be weird again, was very much distorted by a jump in gasoline prices. So if you pull that out of that element, you find out that inflation year over year is running 1.6%, which is a little below the Federal Reserve target and is very, very reasonable. Both of those numbers indicate we have a healthy growing economy.
There's another headline that I could tell you that on the surface can be interpreted probably five different ways, most of them negative. So I'll just read it. Slower workforce expansion seen for the future. Well, that sounds like we're slowing down. No, that's not good. We're slowing down, isn't it? They just said a slower is the first word in the sentence. Well, let's listen to what that actually said. Slower workforce expansion. That means we're growing. It's a slow growth. Negative news would be workforce contraction. Our workforce is not expanding at the same speed that it used to, and that's going to limit some of our growth. That's important information, but that can be interpreted to mean that we're having a slowdown in the economy, which is not, in fact, it's the opposite of what this means. We're having a slower growth rate. It's kind of like, and I've used this analogy before, if you're accelerating, you're in your car, you've got your accelerator pushed down, and you're accelerating, and you slow the acceleration, but you're still going faster every second than you were the second before. That's called a slowed expansion. You're still going faster. You're still better than what you were. And we may or may not have a caller on the line here. I tried to grab it while it was blinking. We'll see what happens. Caller? Nope. Caller is not on the line. Didn't get it in time. Caller, if you want to call back, the number in here is 254-773-1400. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and you can interrupt our absurdity at any time.
And so fundamentally, and this is the thing that we look at across the board, in the background, the economy is doing well. Do we have a caller back?
No, I just wanted to hit one last piece of that, the slowing expansion. Same date, different headline, taking the same data, a shrinking U.S. workforce is stifling economic growth. That headline is a misinterpretation of another one. We don't have a shrinking workforce. It's just not as it's not expanding as fast. We've got more workers today than we did last year or the year before, but as a percentage, more of our people are retired. We just have more people. So there's moving parts in here. Anyway, that was the last piece I wanted to say, is that you can get a headline that they think they're saying the right thing. They've just totally misinterpreted the data.
There's another little blip out there. This is the headline from the Wall Street Journal. U.S. retail sales in January rose more than expected. And that is, believe it or not, a really big thing. Really, really, really big thing, since about 70% of our economy is driven by people buying things here in the United States, which is a tremendous strength. Now, I know there's this complaint that we're not exporting enough and we're importing too much. I don't think that's true, by the way. I think we're exporting more than we're importing, if you figure it correctly. But what is happening is we have this very, very healthy economy in the United States that is unlike other economies, in that most of what we manufacture, most of what we make, most of, for that matter, what we import, is purchased by people in the same country where it's made. In other words, we have our own little ecosystem, if you will. If you yanked all exports out of our economy, we would export nothing. It would reduce our economic engine, our economic growth, our economic vitality by 12%. Now, I don't want to see a 12% drop in the gross domestic product of the United States. It would drop it down below. It would drop it to see we're running about 1.6% year over year right now. So a 12% drop in there would run us down to about 1.2 or 1.4 or something like that. And that wouldn't be good. And we would see jobs lost and tax revenues lost and lots of things would go on. But fundamentally, and this is one of those things that is rare in the world, if we exported nothing, we would not go into a depression. Now, the Germans, it's not true. The Germans, if their exports suddenly stopped, their economy would collapse. The Chinese, if their exports suddenly stopped, their economy would collapse. They're terrified of that. In other words, they are dependent upon other people buying their stuff outside of their country. We aren't. It's that simple. Now, what are we dependent upon? For better or worse, folks, whether we like it or not, there's just a lot of stuff that we don't have in the United States. For instance, a lot of raw materials that we use for electronics. And above all, this is the big one, we don't have enough people, workers, to make all the things we use or assemble, or even assemble and then sell to somebody else in the United States. We just don't have. We are wealthy enough, we are prosperous enough,
yeah,
that we need to hire people outside of our country to make things for us.
And let me say, we've got a population that's big enough to do this. We've got enough people. So when we say we don't have enough people, we've got enough people. And
just not enough workers.
We don't have enough workers. How many of our listeners are retired? Well, a lot of them. And I think I just missed here. Okay, we got a phone call coming in. A lot of people have retired and they've decided that they want to be retired. Well, try to get them to go and manufacture.
I just cut off their Social Security.
Right. Well, that would cause a lot of productivity, or not.
It would cause a new government to be in place.
Right. All right, caller. We have a caller on 773-1400. Go ahead. And they said, oh, they're putting me on the air.
And, you know, this is, and it could be some kind of somebody trying to sell us something, too.
Right.
But we talk about a lot of people if not wanting to work. Well, I was looking at the numbers on there, and the people who are not wanting to work or receive government benefits, I don't know how to break this to you, but the vast, vast, vast majority of them are retired people who don't want to work and who are receiving Social Security and Medicare. So they're receiving government benefits and they don't want to work. Do we have people who we could bring into the workforce who aren't in the workforce? Yes. But generally speaking, they don't have the education or the skills that are needed to do the jobs that we need to do. Something like 47%, now this is an astonishing number to me, of small businesses in the United States are reporting that they have job openings they cannot fill. Let me say that again. 47% of small businesses in the United States, and by the way, the small businesses employ the majority of people in the United States that are employed, have job openings they cannot fill. When asked why you can't fill them, it isn't a matter of bringing in somebody who wants to do manual labor. It's a matter of people don't have the education or the skills to do the jobs. Are they getting applicants for the jobs? Yeah. But the applicants aren't qualified, which means we have a problem that needs a long-term solution. And the long-term solution is we need to take a long, hard look at our education system and compare it with our occupations where we need people to work and right. Say, what are they missing? And they're missing fundamentally basic literacy and math skills. Now, I will say this, Betsy DeVos has got some ideas. And they're different from the ideas that weren't working before. So I'm looking forward to her jumping in. And just like you may think I'm crazy. You probably do think I'm crazy.
No, of course we think you're crazy.
But Scott Pruitt going into the EPA, I know you're going to think I'm a little crazy here, could be something wonderful.
Why there are people that would think that's wonderful because they think the EPA has too much power. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is it may wind up being just as good for the environmental protection, which is what that thing is all about. And that's where you're going with this, I think. Go ahead.
There's a great article in today's Wall Street Journal online. Just put Scott Pruitt, EPA, and you will see the article that where they interviewed Scott Pruitt about what he proposes to do with the EPA. It is refreshing. It is and I don't know if he's going to do everything he said he was going to do. He makes the people on the left crazy because he actually says the EPA has been overreaching. He says,
has been overreaching.
He says, yeah, we need to take a look at carbon dioxide emission and see if it is damaging. But above all, he says, we need to see if we have a legitimate legal means of measuring it and enforcing it. He said there's the law doesn't define carbon dioxide as a pollutant.
Correct. The EPA has given it that definition, but the EPA can take that away.
Right. And so, but he said, here's the issue. The EPA is charged with clean air and clean water, and we've got to do that. And then he makes a very, very, very good point. He said, while we've been fighting carbon dioxide, and he thinks futilely.
I think
so
too.
The Superfund sites are still sitting there, and they're still sitting there in a position where they could pollute the groundwater and everything else around them.
The Superfund sites?
They're called Superfund sites. They are sites where there is intense pollution in the ground,
right,
from some previous plant, and there's nobody.
There's no remediation. There's nobody. Nobody yeah. is on the hook because those plants are from expired businesses.
And he had a really good point. He said we had a Superfund tax, and he wants to reimpose it on industrial output. And it built up a huge amount of money, and a lot of that money is still sitting there, and some of it's been drained off to do other things. But what we haven't done is focus on going in and cleaning up these land polluted areas where there's radioactivity or toxic
right.
chemicals.
This hits a point, and I brought this up over the last year, this Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, this new thing that was created and is going around, and it's trying to protect the consumer. It's just the beginning, I guess the middle part of October, it levied this big hundreds of millions of dollar fine, $185 million fine to Wells Fargo, for those created accounts, those accounts that the Wells Fargo employees created for customers without their permission and charged them money. Wells Fargo came back and reimbursed those fees to the consumer. The Consumer Financial Protection Division comes in and levies a $185 million fine. Now, that it's a big fine, but it's not big compared to the rest of Wells Fargo. Well, that's fine. Okay, you got a fine for...
It's a fine.
You got a fine for doing this. That fine, the revenue from that fine, now goes to education for the consumer. It doesn't go to the people that were wronged. It doesn't go as damages to people who were damaged, even if they were made correct. It should be extra incentive to report when you see a fee that isn't supposed to be on your statement. It should be, well, I'm going to get some extra money from the Consumer Financial Protection Division because they're protecting me. But no, it goes into consumer education. Well, this consumer education would not have prevented Wells Fargo employees from creating new accounts. Having customers that are reporting because they've been incentivized, hey, I'm going to get some money out of this. They're not supposed to be doing this to me.
That's how
you prevent fraud.
Actually, a big chunk of it goes into the budget of the Consumer Protection
Financial Bureau. That's correct.
Financial Bureau. So it doesn't have to be dependent upon Congress.
Yeah, it has to be split two ways, and one part of it goes to make them independent from Congress. Well, that is silly. Now you have a bureau, a bureaucracy by definition, that's self-supporting based on fining people. That means that they're going to go to the places where they believe they can get the most fines, regardless of the protection of the consumer. This is the same thing that we're talking about with the EPA. Well, the Democrats have thought the EPA needs to be ultra strong, and we're going to go and we're going to levy these big fines on these corporations. But then the fine's not used to clean up the environment. It's used for something else. And that, to me, is hypocrisy. If you're going to protect the environment, and that means that we don't want to be able to light our rivers on fire as we did in the 60s. We would like to have rain that does not eat through our umbrellas. Okay? I think we can all agree on that. We are not going to be like China, where if to walk outside is putting your health at risk. We want a good EPA that's not overreaching, that uses the resources that it gathers to clean up the mess, not just to fine people for making a mess and then leaving the mess alone. Once the corporations that make the mess go bankrupt, we still have to clean up the mess, and we're not doing that. So it sounds like we've gone on a weird liberal tangent, but the reality is this is centrist. If you think that dumping your oil change in your front yard is a good thing to do, that doesn't make you a conservative. That's the point. This is not a political Democrat Republican concept. This is, we want a clean environment. We don't want to stifle business in the process. But if a business is doing something that is destroying the property value and the ability for people to live in the area, then they need to be stopped and it needs to be fixed. That's something I think we can all agree on.
You know, and it boils down to the fact that I've been observing the nominees as they've been confirmed, particularly for various government posts, secretary, cabinet levels, and so on. And so far, what I've seen is pretty high-quality results. I am more than a little impressed with this, and I think these things are potentially very, very helpful for the economy. Now, the head of the Labor Department that just pulled out, the new one, yes. And I think there's a couple of ways of looking at this thing. And we've said this before, that some people think that, okay, President Trump has been elected, everything's going to come up roses, and we're all going to go into nirvana. Now, I don't think that's true. The other side is saying that the world's going to end. Well, that's not true either. Frankly, I would like to see a little more positive leadership from the White House and a little less reaction, but that's all right. Who knows? We may get some of that going down the road. The key is that our system is working. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, your last hour you mentioned a lot of the stock market run-up is the promise of, or the hope that the corporate tax rate will be reduced.
That's true.
And my simple thinking, you know, less taxes means less money coming into the government. Mm-hmm. How is that going to stack up against the conservatives in the House and Senate about going
that,
in more.
That is a major. That is a major, major issue. The original plan, I'll just give you that really quick, and then we can talk about it in detail. But the original plan was very simple. They think if they cut the corporate tax rates and throw something else in, like a border adjustment tax, that somewhere down the road in the next 10 years, we'll get a lot of revenue in. But in the short term, we'll just borrow a few trillion dollars.
Now, this comes to an economic principle that's pretty important when you're doing tax planning. And this is revenue for the government, not tax planning for how much taxes you owe. When you're looking at a governmental position, and this is Arthur Laffer, who was the head of the Council of Economic Advisors to Ronald Reagan, came up with this curve. At 0% taxes, you get zero revenue. At 100% taxes, you get zero revenue. Because at 100% taxes, people just don't pay their tax. I mean, they're not going to go to work. This is what caused the downfall of the Soviet Union. It's not immediate. If you set it at 100% tax rate, you're going to get some revenue for a while, and then it's all going to dry up. So the two extremes of ultra high taxes and ultra low taxes lead to zero revenue. Somewhere in the middle is the sweet spot, where if you raise taxes above that point, your revenue drops. It doesn't drop immediately, but it drops pretty quick after that. And if you lower taxes beyond that point, your revenue drops. So finding that sweet spot's important. And with the corporate tax rate, it's really hard to tell where we are on that curve.
And this is the point. The United States has one of the three highest corporate tax rates in the world. But we have, I mean, not in the world, but in the developed world, in the industrialized nations of the world, we also have the lowest personal tax rate of any industrialized nation in the world. We have chosen to tax corporations rather than individuals. It was a choice we made somewhere along the way. Ultimately, there is a bottom line here, and that is if you cut corporate taxes, you're going to have to cause the individuals to pay more somewhere. A border adjustment tax is effectively a value-added tax, which the Europeans already have. That's how they have low corporate tax rates. They have low corporate tax rates because they charge more taxes on their goods and services. If you go over there, for example, in Europe, a liter of gasoline costs about the same as a gallon of gasoline costs over here.
Correct.
Their gasoline prices are four times, it's an easy one to see, four times that of the United States, not because it costs them more to make gasoline, but because of all the taxes that they put on it. The same thing is true if you go into the grocery store and you buy food in Europe. You'll see that the food prices are considerably higher than they are in the United States.
It's because those taxes are due and they're eventually paid by the consumer rather than waiting for periodic intervals to be paid by a corporation. Now, corporate tax rates are still by far the minority of the revenue produced by taxes, but we have a higher corporate tax rate and a lower individual tax rate than almost anywhere else. And by the way, you said of the developed world, we're in the top three. Well, I'm going to have to say that I don't believe Chad is in the developed world. And the United Arab Emirates, I wouldn't put them there. I mean, they're building a lot of stuff, but I wouldn't put them in the developed world either.
I'm trying to be nice here. Actually, we're the highest in the developed world.
Right. In the developed world, we are the highest at a 39% top corporate tax level.
But Chad has higher. Nobody pays it, but they have higher corporate tax.
They also have lead and blood taxes that they charge people when they have little uprisings. And so the concept there is what we're looking at. And then when I was talking about the Laffer point, the Laffer curve, the point where we've got the most revenue, the sweet spot, on the corporate tax rate, it's really hard to tell because we've had this corporate rate for a pretty good long time. We haven't adjusted it much, so we can't see if revenue goes up or down. What we can say with no doubt at all is that the high corporate tax rate is causing corporations that do business overseas to leave the money overseas.
And it's causing businesses, if they build a new plant,
to do it somewhere else.
Right. In other words, you've heard a lot about moving a plant where they're manufacturing something in the United States and moving it to Mexico. And there's some of that going on. The big deal is, if they want to expand production, if you had a choice and you were manufacturing something, we say in the newsletter, widgets, and your profit on the widgets would be taxed at about 40% in the United States, but maybe 15% in Ireland or Mexico or someplace. And would you want to pay 40% tax or 15% tax? And I guarantee we don't have any clients that would voluntarily pay 40% tax when they could pay 50%.
Right. I mean, it's certainly available. And if you are volunteering to pay a higher tax rate, just don't take any deductions. You can do that. Most people do not. So if you have the option to pay a lower tax, that's what people accept. And when we're talking about the corporate tax rate, it is likely that when we lower the rate, we're going to raise the revenue because more things will happen here. But that's an unknown. So it's very hard to do a projection on a revenue increase where we don't know how much. And that's not going to happen immediately, because a plant that may be made in Mexico getting made here is not going to start producing revenue to the government in the first year. It's going to take place over the next decade.
The question was, what about the members of Congress? Well, let me simply say that the Freedom Caucus, those 40 members in the House of Representatives that are quite capable of blocking anything, have said they are not at all supportive of an idea that we will cut taxes and cut revenue now in the hope that revenues will rise at some point in the future, and in between borrow, and I'm not joking when I use this number, approximately $1 trillion more money in order to cover the difference until the new money comes in. And they're looking at the current deficit, and they're looking, which is about $500 billion a year right now, and they're looking at running it up. In other words, basically in 2018, the plan that everybody's so excited about, at least according to the Congressional Budget Office, would run the United States deficit up, well, to say that it would double it and then some, in 2018 if it were passed in 2017. So somebody's got to come, and we actually say in the newsletter, somebody's going to have to pull a rabbit out of a hat around here to get the tax reform that is being floated. I think it may be a good idea. I think a border adjustment tax might very well be a good idea. It would be an experiment, and it would certainly break us out of the rut.
I have looked at history enough to say that I don't think it's a good idea. I don't see where any type of border tax has led to good things long term, because it leads to more border taxes for other countries, and then more border taxes as a response on our part to them raising their border taxes against our border taxes. That's a trade war, and historically they don't do well for anyone. And we've got commercials to play.
All right.
I am interested to see what happens in the experiment, because we've never done a border tax like this one before.
Well, it's effectively the introduction to a value-added tax, which everybody else has got but us.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So we're gonna play some commercials, and we'll be back. If you'd like to join our conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. I'm Jake McClure. That guy over there is Jeff McClure. And we like to talk about the economy. So
we'll be back.
We'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And telephone number in here continues to be 254-773-1400. If today is February 18th, 2017. If not, you can still call the number, just we won't answer. There's some really, really, really good news. I like that.
The really, 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 really.
Yeah, that's the new style, is to say really, really, really. And the leading economic indicators, as published by the Conference Board since 1916. They've been doing this since 1916. The leading economic indicators sound like something pretty cool. I don't know if you're a geek.
You could say The L-E-I.
The Leah. Leah. Lee.
People go, what is that even? I don't know. He said letters. Well, that must be really intelligent, huh?
Well, there's 10 things in the leading economic indicators. And weekly hours, weekly initial, jobless claims, a bunch of stuff like that. Important stuff. And what they're there for, is because these are the indicators that tend to move upward in advance of expansion in the economy, and they tend to move downward in advance of a recession. And they typically give a minimum of 6 months warning. In other words, although right. I will say, for example,
the recession started in mid-2007, but the leading indicators started dropping in mid-2006.
Mm-hmm. So we normally get plenty of warning. Now, every once in a while, the leading economic indicators will send us a false alarm, say, oh, we're going to have a recession, and then we don't. But this is the point. In about 100 years, we've never had a recession without the leading leading economic indicators giving us at least 6 months warning. The leading economic indicators were up 0.2% in November, 0.5% in December, and 0.6% in January. And for the trailing 6 months, which is a really important thing, July through January, they're up 1.6%. What that says is the chances of having a recession in the next 6 months are pretty darned low.
What's more, it means that we're on track for likely between a 2.5% and a 3.5% growth rate.
Yep.
In the economy. The GDP doesn't mirror it exactly. You can't just take the trailing 6 months and double it to get 12 months looking for it. But it shows a lot of what's going on and gives you a pretty good range of expectations on GDP growth. Well, it looks like we've got good growth going mm-hmm. forward. This isn't due to a presidential shift because most people, unless it's in regulatory areas, haven't changed the way they're doing business because somebody else is in the White House. We may have a different confidence level, but that's it.
And it's not a coincidence that the leading economic indicators are actually 125.5 right now, which is very close to where they were at its previous high point in 2006. To put this in a more concrete framework, the leading economic indicators suggest that we have finally recovered from the Great Recession that began at the end of 2007.
Right. Our business, the way we're, you know, one of the leading indicators, this is something people ask me, what's the difference between lagging and leading indicators? What does that even mean? Well, the overall unemployment rate, this is the unemployment rate for people that have been unemployed for a little bit. That's a lagging indicator because these are people that have been unemployed for a while. That means this is something that already happened. New applicants for unemployment is a leading indicator because it says that you know, if those are up, it says that people are getting laid off. If they're down, it means that people are hiring. They're not laying off and they're hiring. So you put those two together and you see we've got a trend going on of more hiring. We've got a trend going on of housing starts are doing quite well. Confidence across most of this period is up in the consumer level. CEO confidence, by the way, jumped tremendously in January, but that may be due to the fiscal stuff going on with the government shift and regulatory changes.
And small business confidence, again, is up dramatically. And I think, again, the small business confidence largely stems from the change in administration, with good cause, by the way.
Obama was not a good friend to the small business.
No, basically the Labor Department under Obama was doing bad things to small businesses.
Bad things being, for the protection of the public, we're going to make you jump through 92 hoops. Three of them are on fire, and we're not going to tell you which ones they are until you get to them, and you will have blindfolds on.
Yeah,
it's not necessarily a bad thing, but that's not a good thing. If I had a choice to whether or not to read seven reams of paper about whether or not I can open a business, I'd prefer just to open the business.
There's a fundamental difference in philosophy. And the philosophy of the Obama administration is some people need help, therefore we're going to do something about it, but we're not going to consider how many people we're going to hurt in the process. That isn't even to be part of the consideration. The new philosophy that's coming in to government appears to be, before we try to fix a problem, let's do an evaluation to make sure that we're not going to create more pain than we relieve. And I know that there's a lot of political implications in taking either position on that, but I can say that we saw regulations come down for businesses that were designed to help employees that ultimately, at least in our opinion, caused small businesses to either not hire people or lay people off or delay increases in pay or eliminate increases in pay for people so that they could pay for something that probably didn't apply to that particular business. So that's a lot of the optimism that's going on in small businesses. Small business optimism is generating small businesses releasing their money to buy things. There's a lot going on.
Right. What we saw,
and most of it's positive,
before the election was a holding pattern in business where they don't know what's going on. Until we figure out who's elected, we're not going to do anything. Well, we had an election. They started doing things. The expansion's there. People are feeling like they can move forward in different areas. We've got business confidence up. We've got market confidence up. Would that have happened if Hillary Clinton had been elected? Maybe. It's really hard to prove or disprove that. So it is likely that just knowing that we had a president selected was a big relief for a lot of us. Going forward, as you said last hour or the beginning of this hour, we have to be careful that we're not making long-term decisions based on promises that may not be kept, not because somebody's breaking their word, but because it requires more than one person to make these decisions.
There's another little tidbit of news that economic news that I found absolutely fascinating. In January, the gasoline use by drivers in the United States dropped to nearly matching a 15-year low. Gasoline sales actually fell 4.4% over the previous year. Now, this is not because the government mandated that you have to have more miles per gallon out of every vehicle or anything else. It just happened. And very frankly, I'm, and a lot of other people are scratching their heads vigorously, trying to say, why did this happen? I think it happened because the price of gasoline went up.
But it didn't go up significantly.
But it went up. It doesn't sometimes have to, this is my point, sometimes it doesn't have to go up significantly. It's up, at 16% from what it was a year ago. That's economics. The bottom line to it is you raise the price of gasoline a little bit and people use less gas. And I don't know what all is happening. Maybe they're all getting cars with phenomenal gas mileages.
Well, that's a big part of it because there have been a lot of cars where we've seen some record years in the last couple of years for car sales. And those new cars that are being sold have a much better gas mileage than the old cars. So that's going to be a cumulative effect. Going forward, we should expect less gasoline sales in the United States, which is going to have an impact on the cost of gasoline. It'll bring the prices down because less people are buying it.
No, actually, it says here, and I'm just taking this from the Wall Street Journal, 32% rise in gasoline prices across the country.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And so this is the point that this is good news for your pocketbook. We now have the highest quantity of gasoline in storage we've had in 27 years. Which leads me to believe that at some point they're going to say that gasoline only lasts so long in storage before we can't use it.
Release the strategic reserves.
And so they're going to start cutting prices on gasoline. Conceivably, if they move slowly, it'll be going into summer vacation time and they'll be cutting prices on gasoline and life will be much more pleasant for people who have to buy gasoline.
Yeah, we're about out of time for this week. If you would like to contact us off the air, we are the Personal Wealth Coach, or two members of it anyway. We do give personalized custom investment advice to high net worth people based on their whole life. What their goals are long term. And if you're interested in that, that's what we do. And if you would like to call us off the air to get that, we have voicemail waiting locally at
254 954-947-1111. That's 254-947-1111.
All right, you can reach that number toll-free, 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can read our philosophy, our newsletters. You can listen to podcasts. I highly recommend checking your medication levels, because more of this may or may not be good for your long-term health. We do very much enjoy what we do, and we will enjoy the relationship we have with our clients. Until next week, this is The Person.
News Radio 1400 KTEM. Serving Central Texas, KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.